The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we'll learn about four ambitious young men whose Sunday morning breakfast meetings sparked a revolution in science. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. My guest is Laura J. Snyder, a professor of philosophy at St. John's University in New York City, and she writes on science and ideas for the Wall Street Journal. She's a Fulbright Scholar, a life member of Clare Hall College, and past president of the International Society for the History of Philosophy of Science. Her most recent book, The Philosophical Breakfast Club, Four Remarkable Friends Who Transformed Science and Changed the World, was an official selection of the TED Book Club, a Scientific American notable book and winner of the 2011 Royal Institution of Australia poll for favorite science book. Great to have you here, Laura.
Thank you, Desiree. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so first question in two parts. What was the Philosophical Breakfast Club, and why is it the first time that I'm hearing about a group that obviously had such a massive impact on science?
Well, the Philosophical Breakfast Club was a group of four men who met as undergraduates at Cambridge University in 1812, and they felt they all shared a love of science and agreed that science needed reforming. So they started meeting over breakfast in the rooms of one of them and talked about how they would bring about a new scientific revolution. And they did, which is amazing. And I had never heard of it either. And no one really has studied the four of these men together. No one really has realized that they were all together in a room at the same time, talking about the same thing. And so when I found out about this, I dove right in, and I really wanted to understand how the fact that they were friends helped them to bring about this scientific revolution.
And who were the members of this club?
The members were John Herschel, the son of the astronomer William Herschel, and the nephew of William's sister, Carolyn Herschel, herself an astronomer. John Herschel would go on to make very important discoveries in astronomy, as well as being the co-inventor of photography and many other things. William Whewell was the master of Trinity College, eventually, the inventor of mathematical political economy, invented the word scientist, which is an interesting story. The third member of the group was Charles Babbage, a brilliant mathematician who invented the prototype for the first modern computer. And the fourth member was Richard Jones, who was the son of a lawyer, himself wanting to study law, but his father pushed him to take religious orders. But he was always most interested in economics and the way that scientific method could be applied to make economics truly a scientific discipline. So the four of these men met and started to hold breakfast on Sunday mornings in Herschel's rooms decided to bring about a scientific revolution guided by their love of the work of Francis Bacon, the 17th century scientific reformer whose works helped bring about the scientific revolution in the 17th century.
Now, how old were these kids? Because they were kids.
They were. They were, 18. Jones was a little bit older. He had not gone to university right away. What's so interesting to me about this dynamic is they had these very grandiose dreams for completely transforming scientific work. And they worked on this project for 50 years until they died. And during this time, they remained friends. They worked together. They wrote many, many letters. They visited each other. And they continued to talk about this project that they had conceived as very young men, which I think is just wonderful.
Well, and that's what's so interesting about this is that science wasn't an esoteric or abstract pursuit for them. They were very concerned with how it could impact the public good.
Exactly. And this is an idea that they partly took from Francis Bacon, who was not only a writer on scientific method, but who was himself a politician in his day, and who always thought that science should be for the good of society. He talked about how science should be for the relief of man's estate, that it should help improve the condition of mankind. And these four men really believed in that and worked their entire lives to show that science should really be for the public good.
So what was the status of science at that time? What exactly were they trying to reform?
Well, at that time, science was really the province of amateurs. It was really impossible to have a career as a scientist, or as that person would have been called in their time, a natural philosopher or a man of science. There were a few professorships of scientific fields at the main universities in England, but those professorships did not actually pay enough for someone to live on them. For instance, the chemistry professor at the University of Cambridge would have to pay for his own chemicals and laboratory equipment. So the scientist at that point was likely to be an amateur clergyman who would collect beetles in his spare time, or someone who was very wealthy and who would build his own laboratory in his basement. It was not someone who could devote his whole life to science. And this is really what they changed. They made science a professional field. They incorporated many of Bacon's ideas that science should be more precise, that accuracy and precision was very important. They thought science should be an empirical-based inductive method, that science should really start from observations and build up general laws from those. And they helped create new scientific societies where the man of science could come together with others and talk about the new discoveries he was making and be helped by a kind of social system of science that men of science could work together to make discoveries and apply them to the conditions around them.
That is terribly ambitious for a bunch of young men.
It's very ambitious. And, you know, I always think about myself at that age. And of course, I think many of us had very ambitious dreams, very grandiose ideas of what we would do when we grew up. So that part is not so surprising. But what's surprising to me is that they actually were able to bring about the scientific revolution that they saw as very young men.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking with Laura J. Snyder, author of The Philosophical Breakfast Club, Four Remarkable Friends Who Transformed Science and Changed the World. Maybe give us a sense of the early lives of these men. What were their backgrounds?
Well, their backgrounds were quite different, but in a way, they were all similar. They were kind of the odd man out. Herschel was the son of William Herschel, the astronomer, who was very well known in science and became wealthy. So John Herschel grew up with some privilege, but his parents had originally put him in Eton, the school that would lead him on, you know, they assumed to Cambridge or Oxford. His mother took him out when she realized he was being bullied by some of the bigger boys. So he was basically left to his own devices at home. His aunt helped teach him. He would do chemistry experiments, but he was really sort of on his own. Whewell was the son of a master carpenter. So he was really not in the lofty classes of the men who usually went on to Cambridge. He was kind of discovered by the headmaster of the grammar school, which is the school that boys intending to go on to university would go to, not usually the sons of carpenters. But he was kind of groomed to win a Cambridge scholarship. So he was kind of the odd man out because his parents were not wealthy, and that was unusual. Jones was the son of a lawyer. He was very sickly when he was young. And so his father thought that becoming a parish priest would be an easy life for him. He was apparently brilliant, but very depressed throughout his life and had severe writer's block, really severe. So it was hard for him to write the works he wanted to. And Charles Babbage, Jones, was the son of a wealthy man, the son of a banker. He too was sickly and not sent off to school when he was young and left to his own devices. He was the kind of boy who would take apart clocks and then put them back together again, very mechanically inclined. And he taught himself calculus before he even reached Cambridge. So they were all brilliant, even at an early age, but more or less probably lonely in some ways. And so I think finding each other at Cambridge really satisfied a deep need to find companionship.
How much do you think the relationships between the members of the Breakfast Club contributed to each member's success? Because these are very disparate fields for the most part.
Well, they saw them as not being disparate, which is what's so interesting. They were really brought together by this idea that science of all types should be conducted in an inductive, empirically based way. And I think it was very important that they found each other and worked together. And that's really what fascinated me when I was writing this project, that each of them individually would probably not have achieved so much if it hadn't been for the relationship between all four of them. You know, they wrote thousands of letters to each other, and I read all of them. And you can see, I know, I mean, that's how I got to know them so well. And you could see them throughout their lives kind of pushing each other, trying out ideas on each other. They were reading each other's works and making comments, working on the same areas together. It was not a well-known fact before that they were all writing about political economy in some way or another at the same time in the early 30s. So you could see this sort of entanglement between them in their ideas. And sometimes it was quite hard to see who had come up with a particular idea first. So I really do think that their association with each other is part of what helped each of them be so successful.
Let's talk about some of their achievements. And I'd like to start with Charles Babbage because he is my favorite. So can you tell us about his life post-Trinity, which is where they met?
Yes. Well, he actually was not at Trinity College. He had started there, but then moved over to a different college. But he was sort of adrift when he left Cambridge. He left under a cloud. He was supposed to be the senior wrangler. Everyone expected him to place top, be in the first place of all the students taking the honors exams. But instead, in a very sort of cantankerous way, he got himself disqualified for that test. So then he was sort of on his own. He married young against his father's wishes, so his father was not willing to support him. He was trying to earn a living. And then all of a sudden, in 1821, he came up with this idea while he was working with Herschel to develop a calculating engine. Because at this time, every professional group needed figures, taxation rates, interest rates, life expectancies, lunar differences for ship captains needed to calculate the longitude while they were in the middle of the ocean. And they all had lookup books where they could look up these calculations because there were no pocket calculators that they could just take out and do quick calculations on the fly. And these lookup books were calculated by part-time workers, mostly men, but sometimes women who would just calculate again and again using a fixed method. And these men and women were called computers, interestingly. And Babbage realized how many errors there were in these tables. You know, the tables needed for the lunar differences for ship captains had over 1,300 calculations per month. And so errors were rife. And Babbage and Herschel, looking at tables like this one day, thought it would be wonderful if a machine could calculate instead of having people. So Babbage came up with this idea, and then he was obsessed with it for the rest of his life. So it gave him a project and a way to use his brilliant mathematical mind. But unfortunately, none of his invented machines were ever built in his lifetime.
Well, and actually, this is where one of the darlings of science history comes in, Ada Lovelace. What's her involvement?
Well, this comes later. In the 1830s, Babbage was working on what he called his difference engine, which would calculate these kinds of tables. And this was a very complex machine. It would need 25,000 parts, which in those days had to each be made by hand. which was an incredibly expensive undertaking. So Babbage, along with his friends, were trying to get the government to give him money to have this built. This became a long, drawn-out process, at the end of which the government had given Babbage the equivalent of $2.5 million in today's money. So Babbage was working on this engine. He kept tinkering with his plans. But while he was trying to get money from the government, he built a small demonstration model of the difference engine. Ada Lovelace, as a 17-year-old, saw this engine and was entranced by it. Ada was the daughter of the poet Byron, who had a very stormy relationship with Ada's mother, Annabella Milbank. Ada's mother had studied mathematics as a girl, which was very unusual. And when Byron was wooing her, he referred to Ada's mother as the princess of parallelograms, which is lovely. But things went downhill fast after that. And by the time Ada was born, her father had already left England and her parents were divorced. So Ada was brought up by her mother, who wanted to do everything she could to keep her from taking on the kind of poetic qualities of her father. So Ada's mother insisted that she study mathematics just like her mother had done. And Ada seems to have had some capacity for that. Ultimately, she was being tutored by the Cambridge logician and mathematician Augustus De Morgan, who thought very highly of her abilities. So she did have some mathematical skills, and she could see the brilliance of Babbage's machine more than many other people could. So when she first met Babbage, she was excited about his difference engine. Years later, after marrying and continuing her studies of mathematics, she decided she wanted to help Babbage, who at this point had developed an even more exciting machine, the analytical engine, which was not just a sort of advanced calculator, but really was like the prototype of a modern computer. It was a fascinating invention, again, never built. Ada thought she could help Babbage popularize or publicize, rather, his analytical engine. So she kept really bothering him in letter after letter. I want to put myself at your disposal. What can I do? And then her role in helping Babbage publicize his analytical engine is a little bit under debate. Some writers on this relationship between them see Ada as the first computer programmer. She had suggested that Babbage create a program for his analytical engine that could calculate the Bernoulli numbers. That's a sequence of numbers where each is determined by all those that have come before. So to get the thousandth number in that sequence, you need to calculate using all 999 before. That was something that his analytical engine could potentially do. So it was which the difference engine could not. So it was a very good idea to have him write a program like that that could be published and people would see what the analytical engine could do. Ada did not write that program, so she was not the first computer programmer. Right. But other people see her as really being nothing more than Babbage's secretary who took dictation from him when they were working on this program. And those people see Ada as basically mad as a hatter. Which she kind of was, actually. In the letters between Ada Lovelace and Babbage, you could see that she really thought of herself as this brilliant person who could transform the acceptance of Babbage's machine all by herself, which was going a little far. But I think the right story to tell about Ada is somewhere in between those extremes. She was not the first computer programmer, but she did understand better than anyone else, perhaps even better than Babbage, that his analytical engine could be a general symbol manipulator, not just a number manipulator, that it could do things potentially like write music, you know, that it could manipulate musical notes and not just calculate numbers. So I think she's fascinating. And although her story's been told before, I think it could be told better.
All right, on to Richard Jones. what would we know him for now?
Very few people know him now.
Which is very distressing because he sounds lovely.
Is lovely. He is the one who you would really want to have dinner with. Although I would love to have dinner with all four of the, or breakfast with all four of the members. But Jones was a bon vivant. He loved good wine. He loved good food. He was, you know, quite corpulent and had many medical problems because of this. But he was charming. You could tell from his letters to William Huell, who he was the closest one to, that he was lovely, brilliant. What we might know about him, if anything, is that he was the major opponent to David Ricardo. David Ricardo's book on political economy really transformed the study of economics, as we would call it today. Ricardo believed that economics should be a strict science like mathematics, as he put it. The members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club were quite distressed when Ricardo's book came out and sort of was transforming the field of economics before their eyes, because they believed that economics was a science. But it wasn't a science like mathematics. It was a science like geology that required evidence gathering and required inductive generalization to laws from the evidence, not just sort of armchair philosophizing about what would be the best economic way to run a nation. Jones felt, as did Huell, Herschel, and Babbage, that the economist, like the geologist, must go out into the field, as it were, to study history, the past and present conditions of different societies all around the globe in order to understand the production and distribution of wealth. Ricardo felt that the proper way to determine the way wealth should be produced and distributed was by sort of reasoning from certain assumed generalities about man's nature, that man is a profit maximizer by nature. But Jones and the others felt that the only way to really understand the distribution of wealth and the production of wealth would be to go out and look and see, not just to sit in your study and think about these things. Jones eventually published a book that was a step-by-step refutation, in a way, of Ricardo, because he showed that many of Ricardo's ideas were quite wrong, and the book was well-received. But Jones had such a problem with writing that it took him a decade or more to write this book. And what's really lovely about his relationship with Huell is that over this time, Huell is sort of the midwife of this book, because he keeps encouraging Jones and sometimes berating him, telling him how important it is to publish his book. As Huell puts it, Jones must go out and slay the Ricardo dragon. Huell and Jones and also Babbage and Herschel were afraid that this view that economics was a mathematical or deductive science was going to infiltrate into other scientific areas. And indeed, as soon as Ricardo's book came out, many people started thinking that perhaps natural science should work in the same way. And this was something the members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club were very much opposed to.
Well, one thing that we should probably mention is, yes, the book was written by Jones, but the information came from all four members of the club.
This was one of the ways that they all helped each other. Huell, at the same time that that Jones was writing this book, Huell was working on a sort of mathematical refutation of Ricardo. And because of that, Huell is considered the founder of mathematical economics, which is a little ironic and sad, because Huell actually thought that economics could not be mathematized. But he kind of did that just to show how ridiculous some of Ricardo's conclusions were. So he was working on this. Herschel, as he was traveling all around the world, would buy books and find out information about the economic systems that he would send back to Jones. Babbage, when he was married, his brother-in-law was actually a member of parliament, and this brother-in-law father-in-law of Babbage would also give Babbage information about economics that he could send to Jones. And Huell as well, when he traveled, would talk to, you know, sort of milkmaids in Switzerland and ask them about their work and, you know, Benedictine monks and, you know, how they farmed their land. So Jones was really helped not only by the encouragement of the other members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club, but also, as you say, just by data collection that they were doing for him.
This is Science for the People, and we'll be back with more of Laura J. Snyder, author of The Philosophical Breakfast Club, after these messages.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by Laura J. Snyder, a professor of philosophy at St. John's University in New York City. She's the author of The Philosophical Breakfast Club, Four Remarkable Friends Who Transformed Science and Changed the World. Let's move on to another member of the club, William Huell. Tell us a bit about him.
Well, Huell is such a wonderful story, and in many ways is the story of a Victorian success. Because he was, as I said, the son of a carpenter. He was expected to take over his father's business one day. But he had this amazing intellect that was recognized even when he was a child. And so he was helped along by others to become someone who could go up to Cambridge. And he did. And he was there with great success. But nobody really ever forgot his humble beginnings. And even in his obituaries, after he was one of the most powerful people in science by the time of his death, people would still remember how he came to Cambridge with handmade clothes and, you know, clunky shoes, which I find a little sad. But he was really a wonderful intellect who not only was he was the driving force, I would say, in the Philosophical Breakfast Club's push for Baconian science in all areas. He could really see how much could be done if an evidence-based inductive method was applied in all areas. And he himself worked in almost all areas, you know, mathematics, mineralogy, of course, political economy. He did a worldwide study of the tides. He wrote poetry. I mean, he was amazing in many ways. What's perhaps the story that best sort of encapsulates how broad his interests were and how important he was in bringing about this scientific revolution in the 19th century is the way that he invented the word scientist. This is how I open the book because I think it really shows how the members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club, led by Huell, really did affect this great change in science. In this period of time, the person who would do science was called a natural philosopher because since the time of Aristotle, philosophy and the study of nature were considered really part and parcel of the same thing. But at the 1833 meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, a group that Herschel and Babbage and Huell helped form several years earlier, Huell was speaking about the role of Francis Bacon and how important he was to renovate scientific work. And when he finished speaking, the poet S.T. Coleridge, who was in attendance, which in itself is sort of amazing, stood up and said, "The members of this organization should stop calling themselves natural philosophers." And I've always thought that his motivation for this was that now the members of the association were the people who were not sitting in their study doing armchair philosophy, not really thinking about metaphysical questions, but were, you know, mucking about in the fossil pits and, you know, doing messy experiments with electrical batteries. And so he wanted there to be a new word to distinguish those people from the real metaphysicians like himself. So he was insulting the crowd, you know, and they were not happy. And then Huell stood up and, you know, in this very polite way said he agreed with the esteemed gentleman that there was no appropriate term for the members of the association. And if natural philosophers was considered to be too wide and lofty a term, then by analogy with artist, he would form scientist. And that's the first use of that word in English in 1833, which I think is amazing. And it was a term that did not take off right away. Other people who were doing science at the time felt that perhaps it was somehow less lofty if they became scientists, because they liked to think of themselves as natural philosophers. And there was a kind of negative association with being a professional group, as opposed to being, you know, the amateur studier of the natural world. But eventually, of course, science did become a profession, in part because of the members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club. And by the end of the century, the word scientist was the word used for the members of the profession. And so we could trace that all really to Huell and the other members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club. And in fact, they were all present at that 1833 meeting of the British Association. It was kind of a reunion for them. Although they had been visiting each other over the years since they graduated, they had not all been at Cambridge again at the same time. And I like to think that, although this is purely speculative, I like to think that the four of them met before the meeting started and they were drinking at the pub or in one of their rooms, and that they kind of were kicking around ideas for what to call the professional man of science. So I do like to imagine the four of them coming up with this word together.
Now, he also had quite an impact on Darwin, did he not?
All members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club did have an impact on Darwin, in fact. When Darwin was a student at Cambridge, he was attending botany lectures of Henslow with Huell. And Huell probably was the one who suggested that Darwin read Herschel's book on scientific method, The Preliminary Discourse on the Study of Natural Philosophy, which appeared the very month that Darwin was taking his honors exams to graduate with honors from Cambridge. And Darwin would later say that reading Herschel's book was the thing in his life that made the deepest impression on him and that made him want to become a natural philosopher. And then later, when Darwin was on the Beagle expedition, they stopped at the Cape of Good Hope, which is where Herschel at the time was charting the stars of the Southern Hemisphere. And Darwin got to meet Herschel and thought it was one of the most wonderful experiences of his life. And so when Darwin was reading Herschel's book and also Huell's book on the history of science, Darwin was starting to form his idea of proper scientific method, which he would later bring to bear when he published Origin of Species. Incidentally, Jones is probably the person who told Darwin to read the work of Robert Malthus on population, which gave Darwin the concept of the struggle for existence, which also became quite important. And there's a very, very interesting way that I think Babbage influenced Darwin as well. So Babbage, in the middle to late 1830s, had built a small demonstration model of his difference engine. It was about 3 feet tall and 2 feet wide and 2 feet deep. And it sat on a table. And he was giving parties or soirees where he would invite men of science and their wives and also political people, literary people, members of the nobility. These were wonderful parties that everybody wanted to go to. In 1837, when Darwin had just come back from his voyage on the Beagle, Charles Lyell, the geologist, told Darwin that Darwin should come with him to one of Babbage's soirees. So he did. And during these soirees, Babbage would demonstrate the model of the difference engine, because at that time, at a big party like this, it was not unusual for there to be some kind of literary, artistic, or scientific demonstration, you know, as entertainment. So maybe someone would bring a telescope, put it out on the lawn, and people would look at the stars. Or they would, the ladies would dress up in costume and sort of, you know, pose as famous paintings. So Babbage, his version of this was he would demonstrate how the difference engine worked to people who were attending his soirees. And he had devised this fascinating mechanism so that the machine could sort of be programmed. That is, it was a feedback mechanism where he could pre-program in that after a certain time of making calculations, the machine would change the rule by which it was calculating. So if, for instance, just to take the simplest example, he would have the machine calculate by adding one. So he would be cranking the handle that would turn all the gears in his machine. And every time he turned it, the machine would count by one, one, two, three, four, five. But then, say, when it reached 99, he would have the machine preset so that it would start counting by twos. And so he would demonstrate this and explicitly point out to people that this change in the law would seem kind of miraculous, because he was just cranking the engine. He was not fiddling around with it to change the law by which it was calculating. And he explicitly compared this to the origin of new species. You know, at the time, almost everybody believed that species were fixed, that God created every species of animal on Earth, and there could be the extinction of a species, but there could not be new species arising unless God himself was coming back in and forming that new species, which they called special creation.
And that's what I think we should probably point out, is that although their work had so much impact on Darwin, Herschel and Whewell didn't exactly accept evolutionary theory.
Well, no. Babbage was a bit of an outlier here. and so I think that watching this demonstration had an influence on Darwin, because he was just back from the Beagle voyage and he was starting to think about how new species seemed to be coming into existence. He was a believer in God at this point, and I feel that Babbage's demonstration gave Darwin a way to incorporate his belief in God with the idea that new species was being formed. That is, that God had sort of preset the creation with these built-in changes to originate new species later on without a new intervention from God. So Darwin then came up with his idea of evolution by natural selection. He did not publish this for 20 years, and he was working just to gather as much evidence as he could. And I feel that he was guided very much by Whewell and Herschel's view of what kind of evidence would make a theory very strong, which they called consilience, that a theory would causally unite many different fields of evidence, many different kinds of evidence, just like Newton's inverse square law of universal gravitation causally united the way that planets moved around the sun, that satellites moved around planets, like the moons of Jupiter, and the way that falling bodies fell. So Darwin spent so long compiling evidence, in part because he wanted to satisfy the way that Whewell and Herschel thought a very strong theory should be proven. However, neither of them accepted Darwin's theory when it first came out. He sent copies of the book to both Herschel and Whewell. He was very crushed to hear that Herschel referred to Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection as the law of higgledy-piggledy. Yes, because Herschel did not like the way that the variations that arise in species were just random. He felt that species might change and perhaps new species were originated, but that it would need some kind of intelligent guidance for them to change into new species. Whewell, interestingly, although he did not accept the theory of evolution, and he was, remember, a clergyman, just like Jones was, Whewell was much more open to Darwin's theory than he was to earlier books that had proposed the possibility of an evolutionary theory. And Darwin was delighted by Whewell's response, which basically was, I don't buy this, but I see that your theory must be taken seriously. That by itself was wonderful news to Darwin. But nevertheless, he was crushed by Herschel's response.
And Herschel, I don't want it to seem like that's the only thing he did, because then there was astronomy and his work at the Mint and the Royal Commission. And this was a very busy and not terribly healthy fellow.
No. In later days, especially, he became quite ill. His work at the Mint was quite difficult for him. You know, what's interesting is that after Herschel finished compiling all of the observations he had made in Africa at the Cape of Good Hope for the years that he was there, he wanted to do something in the government, really as part of that sort of public service component that the Philosophical Breakfast Club thought was so important. And Richard Jones, who was working for the government at that time with sort of the change in the tax code that was taking place, Richard Jones suggested that Herschel get the job of being in charge of the Mint because Isaac Newton had held that position in his day. And Jones helped Herschel get that job because Jones at that point had many contacts in the government. But that turned out to be really horrible for Herschel.
Right,
he was not an organizer. He was not an administrator. And it took a huge toll on his health.
There is so much more to talk about with all these men, but what's your impression that the four had their hands in an absolutely remarkable number of scientific areas? So taken all together, what would you say the impact was on the scientific establishment?
I think the impact was that they transformed science in a drastic way so that science today looks the way it does in great part because of the work of these men. They all did, as you say, work in many different fields. And you could, as I tried to do in the book, trace their influences in many different fields, in political economy, in tidal research, in computer programming. But what's most fundamental to what their work brought about was it changed the image of the man of science. The man of science or the natural philosopher really did become a scientist, a professional who by the end of their lives could begin to earn a living just as a man of science, just as a scientist. They really brought to the fore the idea that science should be for the public good, that it wasn't just useful to compile natural laws and scientific knowledge for the good of a king or for one's own personal gain, but that you should try, as Bacon had said, to use science to make man's life better. They pushed very hard for the idea of an empirical-based inductive method, and they were successful. I mean, if you look at science today, you could see the model that they had set for scientific research. They formed these new scientific societies that were much more professional. You had to really be an active scientist to be part of the British Association. And these societies gave women a foot in the door of science. The British Association meetings encouraged the members to bring their wives and daughters. And at first, the women just went to the public lectures and the social events that took place at night. But they started infiltrating, in a way, the sessions. And this was allowed. And little by little, men of science got used to be, you know, there being women around, which I think was very important. And they also pushed for the idea of external funding, that you didn't have to pay for your own research or your own chemistry equipment or chemicals, that there should be grants given to support scientific research. So in these ways, I think they shaped the scientific enterprise to look very much like it does today.
Laura, it was a wonderful book. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You can find a link to Laura J. Snyder and the Philosophical Breakfast Club on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back with Skeptic contributors Amy Davis Roth and Melanie Mallon to find out about Skepticon, the science track at the Convergent Science Fiction and Fantasy Convention. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're thinking about thinking and the capacity of the not-so-humble human brain. We'll speak to science writer Fritjof Capra about his book Learning from Leonardo, Decoding the Notebooks of a Genius. We'll take a look at IQ testing with author and psychology professor Scott Barry Kaufman, and we'll talk to Chelsea Dufresne and Andrew Tripp about this year's Skeptech Conference. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I wanted to give a bit of a signal boost to a conference I love. I have two wonderful people here with me, Melanie Mallon and Amy Davis Roth, also known as Surly Amy. Thanks to both of you for coming.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So we're here to talk about Skepticon, which is what?
Skepticon is what we call the science track at an event called Convergence. And it is a track that is primarily run by women, and it has been organized by a blog called Skeptic. And I will let Melanie jump in and give some of the details about what it actually encompasses.
Convergence is a sci-fi fantasy con in the Minneapolis, Minnesota area. And so what we do, Skepticon, we bring science, because there's a lot of overlap, if you think about it, with an audience of people already interested in science, but just from a different direction. They're interested in science fiction and fantasy. So there's a lot of room for education and outreach about science and getting everybody interested in it, because it's not just for scientists, obviously. So not only do we have straightforward panels on science topics, but we also have this opportunity to look at science through the lens of fiction and art and all sorts of kind of different fun angles. And so we have panels, we have workshops, we have activities and all sorts of kind of science and art, STEAM, I guess you would call it, focus.
For anyone who doesn't know, what's Skeptic?
Skeptic is a blog that it sort of originally was about skepticism. So it was started by a woman named Rebecca Watson, and she was on a podcast. She still is, called SGU, which is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And she found herself in a position where it was sort of a male-centric community. There wasn't a lot of people talking about skeptical issues that applied to women. And so she started this blog called Skeptic. And she, as she sort of built energy, she brought on more writers. And her focus has sort of grown over the years. And I've been a contributor to the site for, I believe, like 6 years now. She has added a lot more scientists. And so I guess the scope of the site has sort of spread out from just the basics of Skepticism 101, which we've covered over the years and are, you know, quite comfortable with, but more interesting topics like science and social justice and feminism. And so Skeptic is sort of this great destination point on the internet where if you want to learn about anything from astronomy to biology to Bigfoot, you can actually go there and get information that's going to be science-based and from a woman's perspective.
So back to the con. Now, if you were walking around Convergence, what would you see?
Convergence is amazing. It's like And I think a lot of your listeners, or at least your listeners that are in the United States, might be familiar with Dragon Con or Comic Con, but it's more like Dragon Con. Convergence is more like Dragon Con. It's more sci-fi, it's more friendly, and it's quite a bit smaller, but it's growing every year. I believe they get about 5,000-6,000 people each year. You'll have people dressed in cosplay. There's art tracks, there's theater, there's science, there's sci-fi, and it's just a really great, friendly, fun conference that we've been really thankful to be a part of over the years, and we've grown over the years. And what's really fantastic, and why Melanie is here talking with us, is that she's now actually part of programming for the event itself, and we're really super thrilled about that, because now we've been able to expand the science track, which is sort of like a main focus for us at Skeptic, to get science out to the general public. And so what we do is we bring in scientists from all over the world, from all over fields, and we put panels together that we think people that are interested in maybe sci-fi or more lay people might be interested in. Like, for example, we have panels like Ask a Scientist. So we put a whole panel together with someone from astronomy, someone from biology, someone from forensic science, someone from physics. We put everybody up on a panel, and someone like me, and by the way, I'm an artist. I don't know if we even sort of got to that. I am just a little multimedia artist that does photography and ceramics, and I paint. So someone like me, who has not been educated in science, gets an opportunity to interact with these, like, you know, big time, super smart science people, and I can ask anything, you know, like, why is there gravity? Or is a meteor going to crash through the ceiling? And am I even using that word correctly? You know, there's, you know, an opportunity to interact with scientists, and it's extremely inspirational for someone like me to have that opportunity. And we hope to share that same thing with other people, and adults and kids and teens, and everyone, you know, is welcome. There's different panels and different activities that are geared to all sorts of people. And we have parties.
Well, Mel, what kind of panels might we see this year?
The one I'm most excited about is Things I Licked for Science. We were discussing with the various scientists who will be our guests at Convergence different panel ideas, and it just kind of came up that, oddly, a number of different science fields, they lick things for various purposes. So,
like on purpose?
On purpose, to actually make determinations and to gather evidence and data. So that's definitely one that I'm very, very interested in. Because this is a sci-fi fantasy con, we have a lot of kind of different angles we can go through, you know, different media. So we have physics of the Whedonverse. We're going to go into the science of the show Breaking Bad. We will be doing several panels that are just kind of covering the usual, you know, monsters and fairies and dragons. But what I think is really interesting, for example, we'll have a real monsters panel that actually covers bizarre creatures that actually exist. So, you know, we can kind of take the interests of the people who are already going to the con and cross it right into, hey, look, there's some stuff in reality that's pretty much just as cool as the fiction you're reading. And we're also going to be, you know, going into some basics, evaluating scientific claims and women in STEM and science for rationality and that's that sort of thing. One thing that's really cool for, you know, if your audience is already interested in science, what's really cool about going to a sci-fi fantasy convention is that, you know, you can go to an evaluating scientific claims panel and people are in costume. I mean, it's, you know, the whole atmosphere of it is just, it's such a beautiful combination of art and science.
Well, I should probably say, full disclosure, I do often moderate some of the Skepticon science panels when I'm able to attend. And I've been a part of the climate change panels specifically. I love those. But last year I did a food sustainability panel with Valentine Keggio and Emily Cassidy. And it was so wonderful that we actually reprised it on air here. So, of course, I do hope to attend this year, schedule willing.
Oh, yeah, we're really excited to have you there. You're definitely one of our favorite guests every year, Desiree, so I hope you can make it.
I hope I can make it, too. So, now, one thing that's interesting is I know that there are occasionally scientists and non-scientists at the same time on the science panels, which I think is a really interesting idea. So, why the mix?
Well, I think that it sort of encompasses what our main goal is, and that is sort of to break down the barriers that stand between the academics and the lay people. And I'm sort of a perfect example of that. I'm just an average artist. I didn't get a lot of higher education, but I'm really interested in science. And so to be able to be maybe on a panel where we're discussing art and science, and that's, you know, sort of one of the panels that we do a lot, we'll have actual scientists, and then we'll have someone like me up there who's an artist, it breaks down these barriers of, you know, getting the information out. So the scientists are, you know, able to speak to their audience where they're often speaking to other scientists. There's an opportunity to talk to someone like me and help me to understand, you know, the complications of the latest research. And I think it's sort of what this podcast or this radio show is about. It's, you know, it's getting science to the people. It's giving me an opportunity to actually learn from the actual working scientists. So it's really fantastic to get the two people together.
So what else might one do at the con?
Can I jump in and say that yes. My favorite part is the sandbox activities, and they're geared towards kids, but we bring in this one scientist named Susie Wiles, and she does a bioluminescent art workshop where kids get to draw with a bacteria that actually will, then it'll glow the next day. It becomes art. And so there's really fantastic projects to get kids excited about, you know, being scientists or understanding science in their life. We also did a paper doll sandbox last year where we had all these artists from one of the blogs that I manage, which is Mad Art Lab. They drew scientist paper dolls. And so each artist got to stand up and explain what the scientist did, what his work was or her work was. And then the kids got to make paper dolls of the scientists and take them with them. So I get really super excited, obviously, about the art projects that we do that have to do with science.
We'll also be having, for the sandbox workshops, we'll be having Secret Agent 101, extracting DNA and actually making a necklace of it, real DNA, playing with your food, molecular gastronomy, edible astronomy, all sorts of fun workshops. And in addition, new this year, in our track room, probably one of the most fun aspects of Convergence is every night you don't have to worry about where to go or what to do. There are two floors of hotel rooms that kind of go around the garden court, and different people will take over a hotel room and decorate it according to various themes. You know, so of course you've got your typical sci-fi and fantasy themes. You've got your toast bar where you can get toast with oysters on it, gummy bears, ridiculous things, as well as butter, I hope. So in any case, people go from room to room and they can get food and drinks and that sort of thing. We've decided this year we're going to open our track room during the day and host kind of mini versions of the sandbox workshops and have all sorts of science and art activities in our track room that people can just kind of come and go and do as they please, as well as salons with the various scientists and the Mad Art Lab artists and the skeptics from the entire Skeptic Network. So you can have this kind of one-on-one discussion time in addition to the panels and the workshops.
So when is this magical event?
July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, in the Minneapolis area. You can register for Convergence at convergence-con.org. And you can also find out more about the science track, the Skepticon track, at skepticon.com.
One of the things that I've done to get involved in science is to make art that encourages critical thinking and encourages science. And that art project is called Surly Ramics. And I make ceramic jewelry that has, you know, little bits of information on it. It will have DNA on it. It will have molecules on it. It will have, you know, little quotes or things that will encourage people to learn more about science. And what I do with that project every year is I find a conference, because I also feel that the social aspect of science is important, that we need to get together and gather at these events. And I know that they're expensive for a lot of people. And for example, the first time I ever went to a science conference, it took me a year to save up the money to buy the ticket to go. And so now that I'm in a position where I can sort of give back, I try to do exactly that by using my art to raise money to pay for people to go to these events. So this year, I am going to be focusing on Skepticon at Convergence, and I am going to be designing a line of jewelry. Well, I've actually already designed it. And I'm going to sell that on my little Etsy shop. And I take half the money and I use that money to pay for passes to go to this event. So this year, I've designed a whole bunch of different necklaces that simply say, I love science. And I'm going to be selling them on my Etsy shop. And I'm going to use the money to pay for people to go. So I'm hoping that the community will sort of help me out. And I'm also hoping that if there's someone out there that really wants to go to this event, but is short on cash and they can't afford to go, I want you to have an option to be able to make it. So if you just go to skepchick.org and on the front page, there's a little side ad that says, I love science at Skepticon. And if you click on that, it will bring you to a blog post where you can just sign your name up in the comments. And I'm going to put a bunch of names in a hat. And I promise that I will pay for at least one person other than myself to go to this event. So I will buy passes. I can't pay for hotels, but I'm going to use the proceeds from any jewelry that I sell to buy some passes for some people out there that hopefully are just like me 6 years ago when you didn't know anything really about science, but you knew you wanted to learn more. And this conference is a great place to go and make new friends and learn something. So just go to skepchick.org and click on the little side thing that says, I love science at Skepticon, and sign up in the comments or, you know, help out if you have extra money by buying an I love science necklace. And I hope to see you all at Convergence.
Adjust your travel plans for this summer accordingly, folks. We've posted the link to Skepticon on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. Go forth and click. And maybe while you're there, also click the various links to our Twitter feed, our Facebook page, and to iTunes so that you can download past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.